Saturday is the centenary of the birth of Raymond Chandler. To mark the occasion, we've a rare chance now to hear him in conversation. 30 years ago, for the third programme, Ian Fleming talked to him, though technically the recording hasn't lasted quite as well as we'd have hoped. Their conversation is introduced by Philip French.
Raymond Chandler was born in Chicago 100 years ago this week, though the city he'll always be associated with is Los Angeles. Back in the 1930s, he was one of the handful of writers who discovered and possessed L.A. for literary purposes. For many of us, Philip Marlowe will always go down its mean streets on his nightly errands, nightly as both nocturnal and chivalrous. But Chandler has a close association with another town, London. He was 7 when his parents' marriage broke up, and his Irish mother brought him here to live in genteel poverty. Like the creators of two other legendary serial characters, P.G. Woodhouse and C.S. Forrester, he attended Dulwich College, and on leaving school he made a false start as a literary journalist. But he didn't write well enough to make a name as a Georgian belles-lettrist, or fast enough to become a successful hack. So at the age of 23, he returned to the States, settling in Los Angeles. He didn't take up writing again until he lost his job as an oil company executive in 1932 and began contributing hard-boiled stories to Black Mask magazine. But he never lost a rather dreamy love of England and later attributed enormous importance to his classical education. "If I hadn't grown up on Latin and Greek," he wrote, "I doubt if I would have known so well how to draw the line between what I call a vernacular style and what I should call a faux-naive style." And his biographer, Frank McShane, observed, "Unlike James, Conrad, or Joyce, who were in exile from worlds they detested, Chandler was in exile from a world he thought he loved. Instead of his admired England, he lived in a place where values seemed to shift with the tides." But Chandler had another reason for liking this country. To his annoyance, and he was a curmudgeonly character, what the Jacobeans would have called a malcontent, he was never taken seriously by American critics. They treated him merely as a writer of thrillers, not as a serious novelist. But in Britain, it was otherwise, and I recall as a provincial sixth former back in 1951, listening on this channel, the third programme, as it was then called, to a superb talk by the late H.A.L. Craig, colourfully entitled The Whiskey of Affliction, The Pistols and Pieties of Raymond Chandler. And in 1954, Chandler wrote a letter referring to a discussion of his novel, The Long Goodbye, on the home service programme The Critics, forerunner of Radio 3's Critics Forum. "I may be the best writer in this country," he said, "and with two exceptions, I think I am. But I'm still a mystery writer. For the first time in my life, I was reviewed as a novelist, capital N, in the London Sunday Times. And I was discussed on the BBC by as adult a group of so-called intellectuals, among whom Dillis Powell hardly got a word in, has ever had soup on their best. But over here..." In 1952, Chandler made his first visit to London since before the Great War. And from 1954 onwards, after the death of his beloved wife, he was a frequent visitor. This once handsome man was, at the age of 66, a wreck, depressed, alcoholic, written out. But he was lionized, and one of his new friends was Ian Fleming, whose Bond novels he'd been the first to appreciate. He reviewed Diamonds Forever in the Sunday Times, providing the kind of serious criticism he wanted for himself. And in 1956, in a letter to Fleming, Chandler said, "I did not think that I did quite do you justice in my review of your book, because anyone who writes as dashingly as you do ought, I think, to try for a little higher grade. I have just reread Casino Royale, and it seems to me that you have disimproved with each book." Fleming took this to heart. And his biographer, John Pearson, states that it was undoubtedly Raymond Chandler's interest which restored Fleming's enthusiasm for his writing and his hero. In July 1958, the poet and novelist George Macbeth, at that time a BBC Talks producer, brought Fleming and Chandler together on the air. The occasion was the publication of Chandler's last book, Playback, and the theme, British and American Thrillers. Fleming and Macbeth picked up Chandler at 11 a.m. on the day of the recording and found his voice slurred with whiskey. But they got into Broadcasting House, and all apparently went reasonably well, though there was a certain amount of editing on the tape. "I remember," Fleming later wrote, "that in discussing Mickey Spillane and his retreat to expiate guilt into the arms of the Seventh-day Adventists, Chandler commented, "In a way, it's a shame that boy was the greatest aid to solitary sin," he used a blunt word for it, "in literature." Later, he apologized to the two pretty girls in the control room, and one of them said, "It's quite all right, Mr. Chandler. We hear much worse things than that." Their conversation was broadcast on the third program, and according to Frank McShane, it's the only recording in existence of Chandler's voice. 7 months later, on March the 23rd, 1959, Chandler died at his home in La Jolla, a small town north of San Diego. The day they taped their conversation was the last time the two writers met. And in this recording from the BBC archives, Ian Fleming speaks first.
Well, the first thing, I suppose, Ray, really, is to define what we're supposed to be talking about. And I think the title of what we're supposed to be talking about is English and American thrillers. The first thing is, what is a thriller? In my mind, of course, you don't write thrillers, and I do.
I do, too.
I don't call yours a novel.
Well, other people call them thrillers.
I know, I think it's wrong.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you write novels of suspense, like Simenon does and Eric Ambler does, perhaps, but in which violence is the background, just as love might be in the ordinary kind of straight
well,
novel.
Well, in America, a thriller or mystery story writer, as we call them, is slightly below the salt.
Well, the thriller writer, he is very below the salt, really.
You can write a very lousy, long, historical novel full of sex and can be a bestseller and can be treated respectfully.
Yes.
But a very good thriller writer who writes far, far better just gets a little paragraph, that's
yes,
all.
Yes, I know, it's such a truth.
Mostly.
Yeah.
There's no attempt to judge him as a writer.
Well, I don't know, I suppose. But you yourself are judged as a writer, and Dashiell Hammett was,
yeah,
I think.
Yes, sir, but how long did it take me? You starved to death for 10 years before your publisher knows you're any good.
Well, yes, because your first story is now a very valuable first edition. Where do you get your material? I mean, nearly always a Californian setting, isn't it? Has it ever not been a Californian setting?
Well, I lived many years in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles had never been written about. California had been written about, a book by called Ramona.
Mm.
A lot of sentimental flop. But nobody in my time had tried to write about Los Angeles background in any sort of realistic way.
No.
Of course, now half the writers in America live in California.
Because Nathaniel West did, I think, didn't he? At least,
Yeah, but he came along much, much later.
Yes, he did. That's quite true. Well, so far as my material is concerned, I'm afraid I just get mine by going to places and taking down copious notes, because I can't remember anything.
Yes, but you're an experienced journalist.
Well, I think that's sort of the answer.
Yeah.
And then I learned my writing.
Yeah. You can go to Las Vegas, and you can get Las Vegas in a few days.
Yeah.
Except the ice water.
Right. Oh, yes, you complained about some of one of the meals that my James Bond ordered in Las Vegas. I described the meal, and I didn't get him the waitress bringing the ice water the first thing. Wasn't that your complaint?
Well, that amused me, because that's the first thing that happened in an American restaurant.
I kicked
myself. It's a glass of ice water, put down by the waitress or the bus boy.
Yeah. I kicked
the bus boy is comparable to a commie here.
Yeah. Yes, because I rather pride myself on trying to get these details right, and that is a very bad break.
But I don't think any English writer has ever got as many right as you have.
Well, I don't know. It's laborious work.
I mean, that stuff in Harlem was wonderful.
Was it?
I thought it was, and also in St. Petersburg.
I rather like St. Petersburg.
Oh, I don't think any American could have done it more accurately.
I find, I don't know if you do, extremely difficult to write about villains. Villains I find extremely difficult people to put one's finger on. You can often sort of find heroes wandering around life and meet them, come across them, and plenty of heroines, of course, but the really good, solid villain is a very difficult person to build up, I think.
I don't think I ever, in my own mind, think anybody's a villain.
No, I think that comes out in the book. But you have some quite top villainous people there.
Yes, they exist.
I see they had another killing last week in New York. One of these men connected with that Doc Union man. What is his name?
But Anastasia?
Anastasia, yes. How's a sort of killing like that arranged?
Very simply. You want me to describe how it's done?
Yes.
Well, first of all, the syndicate has to decide that he must be killed. They don't want to kill people.
No.
It's bad business nowadays.
Yeah.
Then when they make the decision, they telephone to a couple of chaps, say, in Minneapolis, who own hardware stores or something or other, and have a respectable business front. And these chaps come along to New York, and they're given their instructions. And they're told, they're given a photograph of the man and told what's known about him. And when they get on the plane, if they have to get on the plane,
in Minneapolis,
they're given guns.
When
no,
they get
not
on...
in Minneapolis.
Oh.
No, after they get their instructions.
Yeah.
They're given guns.
Yeah.
Now, these guns are not defaced in any way.
No.
But there are guns that have passed through so many hands that they can, present owners can never be traced. The company could say the first purchaser. So they go to where the man lives. They get an apartment across the street from him, or a room. And they study him for days and days and days until they know just exactly when he goes out, when he comes home.
Yeah.
What he does, and when they're ready, they simply walk up to him and shoot him.
Mm.
They have to have a crash car. Bugsy Siegel was a great man for the crash car.
Yeah.
The crash car is in case a police car should come down the street.
Yeah.
And it accidentally, on purpose, smashes the police car.
Yes, I see.
So they ever thought to get away, to get back from the plane, go home. That's all there is to it.
And they drop the guns. They drop the guns at the spot. Do they leave?
They always drop the guns. Yes.
And wear gloves.
How many fingerprints have ever been taken off guns?
Yes, quite.
So they always hold them by the butt.
Yes. That's quite true. Of course, they always appear to be taken off in books, but I suspect that because by filing the material on the butt. Scraping it well, of course, you make a rough surface, it won't take any prints at all.
No. The butts aren't made that way.
No.
They're made to be rough.
Yes, quite true. How much do they get paid for that each?
$10,000
each?
Mm-hmm. If it's an important man.
Yes.
A small money to the syndicate.
Yes. And then they go back to their jobs in the hardware stores in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Quite impersonal.
Yeah, they don't mind one way or the other.
They don't care anything about the man. They don't care if he's dead or alive.
No.
It's just a job to them.
Yeah.
Of course, they have to be a certain sort of people,
yes,
or they wouldn't do it. I mean, they're not like us. We wouldn't do it.
No. Difficult thing to imagine doing.
Well, I've known people I'd like to shoot.
For instance? Anybody in England?
No, not in England.
Mm-mm. What do you want to shoot them for?
I just thought they were better dead.
But again, to go back to villains, because the difficulty is, in writing about a man such as the people you describe, is to be certain oneself and to be able to persuade the reader that the man is not to be pitied for being a sick man. It's difficult to depict somebody who really is tough without being a psychopath.
It's almost impossible to imagine an absolutely bad man who is not a psychopath.
It is, I know. And then you see you create pity for him at once. It's difficult. That's what I mean about villains.
Well,
they're very difficult people to build up.
Well, he may have his very human side. He may be very kind to his family.
Yes.
But in his business, illegitimate,
yeah,
he may be quite ruthless.
Mm. One's got to know these people. You can't invent them.
You don't find anyone, really, that's all bad.
Now, do you think, so far as heroes are concerned, because your hero, Philip Marlowe, is a real hero. I mean, he behaves in a heroic fashion. My leading character, James Bond, I never intended to be a hero. I intended him to be a sort of blunt instrument wielded by a government department who would get into bizarre and fantastic situations and more or less shoot his way out of them, get out of them one way or another. But, of course, he's always referred to as my hero, but I don't see him as a hero myself. I think he's
on the whole, you ought to.
You ought to, I know, because then he would have more... I'd certainly write about him with more feeling and more kindness, probably.
Well, I think you did in Casino Royale.
Do you?
Yes.
Well, he had some emotions at the end when the girl died, but that...
That's all right. A man in his job can't afford tender emotions.
Well, that's what I feel.
He feels them, but he has to quell them.
Yes. On the other hand, Philip Marlowe feels them and speaks about them.
He's always confused.
He is, isn't he?
He's like me.
But, for instance, I mean, I managed to get out of an advanced copy of your last book, the one that's just coming out, Playback. And, I was very interested by this passage, talking about violence and, toughness and so on and so forth. This seemed to me very well put. He's gone into this girl's bedroom, having overheard her conversation with a blackmailer. She brought out a small automatic up from her side. I looked at it. "Oh, guns," I said. "Don't scare me with guns. I've lived with them all my life. I teased on an old Dellinger. Single shot, the kind the riverboat gamblers used to carry. As I got older, I graduated to a lightweight sporting rifle, then a .303 target rifle, and so on. I once made a bull at 900 yards with open sights. In case you don't know, the whole target looks the size of a postage stamp at 900 yards. A fascinating career," she said. "Guns never settle anything," I said. "They're just a fast curtain to a bad second act." I think that's well put. But you see, that is a far more sort of sensible point of view than the one which I put forward in my books, where people are shooting each other so much and so often that you often need a program to tell who's in the act and who's the spectator.
Why do you always have to have a torture scene?
Well, do I always? Yes, let me think now.
Yes,
well,
I'll tell you,
maybe you're right.
Every one that I've read.
Really? Well, you see, I suppose I was brought up on Dr. Fu Manchu and thrillers of that kind, and somehow always, even Bulldog Drummond and so on, the hero in the end gets in the grips of the villain, and he suffers. Either he's slogged or something happens to him.
Try brainwashing. That's probably worse than torture.
I think it is, yes. I don't like that. That's too serious. No, I agree. I think it's a weakness. On the other hand, you see, I think this so-called hero of mine, he's has a good time. He beats the villain, and he gets the girl, and he serves his government well. Well, in the process of that, he's got to suffer something in return for all this success. And, I mean, what do you do? Dock him something on his income tax? I'm a bit tired of the fact that the hero in other people's thrillers gets a bang on the head with a revolver butt and he's perfectly happy after it's just a bump on his head. Well,
yeah.
I think my chap ought to...
Oh, that's one of my faults. I recover too quickly.
Well, I know. Well,
because I know what it is to be banged on the head with a revolver butt. The first thing you do is vomit.
It is, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there you are. See, that's already getting... violent and unattractive and so on.
Yes.
The truth is like that, you see. And while I think it's certainly a criticism of my books that it comes in too often, I think my so-called hero has got to suffer before he gets his prizes at the end of the book.
Yes, he's got to suffer a little, that's true.
Yeah.
But...
Not too much. Well, he doesn't get hurt in the next book, which I've just written. Much.
Have you?
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Goldfinger.
Which?
Goldfinger.
How can you write so many books with all the other things you do?
Well, I sit down and I have 2 months off in Jamaica every year. That's sort of in my contract with the Sunday Times. And I sit down and I write a book every year during those 2 months. And I bring it back.
I can't write a book in 2 months.
Well, but then you write better books than I do.
Well, maybe or maybe not, but I still can't write a book in 2 months. The fastest book I ever wrote, I wrote in 3 months.
Yes. Well, Simonal writes them in about a week or 10 days.
Mm-hmm. And so could Earl Stanley Gardner.
Yes.
In fact, or Edgar Wallace.
Yeah.
The novel story about Edgar Wallace going to Hollywood. And they asked him if he would write an original story for a screenplay. And they expected him to take about 6 weeks. This was on a Friday. He was back on Monday, but it finished.
Well, I tell you, they paid him for the whole 6 weeks.
Well, I think it's a flat sum.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. But your man, your hero, Philip Marlowe, is he based on more or less on yourself, so to speak? I mean, I see a distinct relationship between you and Philip Marlowe.
Oh, not deliberately.
No, but
if so, it just happened.
One writes about what one knows, of course. Well, my chap, I suppose he's got some foibles that I've got, but I wouldn't have said he had any relation to the person I think I am, but there it is.
Can you play baccarat as well as he can?
Not as well, no. I'd like to be able to. I love it. I love gambling.
Oh. I don't enjoy gambling at all. It's the only vice I don't possess.
Oh, come. There are plenty left, aren't there?
Well, it is the only vice I don't possess. I have no interest in gambling.
No. Would you say that there are any sort of basic differences between the English and the American thriller?
Oh, yes. Except for a few exceptions, like... I shouldn't say except for a few exceptions. It's a bad tautology, isn't it? Like yourself. Mm-hmm. And there are a few. The American thriller is much faster paced.
Yes. We've got into a rather sort of tea and muffin school of writing here, I think. You know, the policemen are much too nice and always drinking cups of tea and inspectors puff away at pipes. The whole thing goes on in a rather sort of quiet atmosphere, some little village somewhere in England.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you've got the private eye tradition, which we haven't got so much over here because our detectives, the private detectives, on the whole, the ordinary little people who go and follow married couples around and try and catch them out and so on.
So they are in America.
Yes, but of course they're written up to be much more.
Oh, well, the private eye is a catalyst.
Yes.
He's the man who resolves the situation.
Yes.
He doesn't exist in real life.
No, he doesn't.
Unless you can make him seem real.
Yes.
He doesn't make any money, either.
Marlowe seems real to me. I mean, I visualize him quite clearly.
Oh, I know, but that's because I've known him so long. That
yeah.
He's not real as a specimen of a private detective.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the same thing applies to Secret Service agents. I mean, I've known quite a number of them, and on the whole, they're very sort of quiet, peace-loving people who you might meet in the street, sitting next to you in your club. Mm. In fact, two or three do sit next to me in my
club. They must have an immense interior courage, though.
They must, because it's a dull job, and they get no thanks for it, and they get no medals. And, well, it's pretty bad on the wires, too. They have a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the danger and all this, which does occur.
Wives of policemen don't have a very good time in America.
They don't.
The policemen get shot every once in a while.
Yes, because you shoot much more than we do over here.
Well, they carry guns.
Yes.
Although I've known a police captain in Ohio who carried a gun for 28 years and never used it except when he required to on the police pistol range to qualify. He never shot a man with it.
No. Well, I was head up in America going about 96 miles an hour last year in a Studilac, which is a favorite car of mine in America. It's a combined Studebaker and Cadillac. And I went along to the sheriff's office by this speed cop, and we got more or less friendly, and he showed me his gun, and I said, "You ever let this off in anger?" And he said, "I wouldn't think of doing so." He said, "The number of forms we have to fill up for every time we let off a gun is so dreadful." He said, "I might throw it at somebody, but I'd certainly not fire it." He's a wonderful chap. Well, we should be talking a little more about real crime than sort of fictional crime. Have you sort of planning any kind of a new book now? I mean, we've got this one coming out today.
Well, I got myself in a bad spot now.
In what way?
The fellow has to get married.
He is. Marlowe's going to get married, is he?
Yes, but there's going to be an awful struggle. So she's not going to like him sticking to his rather seedy profession, as she'd consider it.
Yeah.
And he is not at all going to like the way she wants to live. In an expensive house in Palm Springs, a lot of freeloaders coming in all the time. So it's going to be a struggle. May end in a divorce. I don't know.
Oh, golly. You wouldn't like to go and kill her off, perhaps?
Kill her?
Yeah.
Oh, no. She's too nice.
She is, is she?
Uh-huh.
Linda, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Much too nice to kill off.
Oh. Oh, well. Well, I don't think my fellow's going to get married.
Of course, if I had Marlowe killed off and solved a lot of problems, I wouldn't have to write any more books about it.
Well, you've always meant to write a play anyway, haven't you?
Yes, I want to write a play.
Yes.
I want to write a play about Luciano, if you'll let me.
What we've talked about, really, are the basic ingredients of thrillers. I mean, really, our conversation has covered more or less. One could write almost a couple of books on what we've been talking about. I mean, the Luciano situation is one, and a detailed story of one of these gang killings, as you described, the man coming down from Minneapolis, is another one. But I wonder what the basic ingredients of a good thriller really are. Of course, you could have taste. It should start with the first page and carry you right through. And I think you've got to have violence. I think you've got to have a certain amount of sex. You've got to have basic plot. People have got to want to know what's going to happen by the end of it.
Yes, I agree. There has to be an element of mystery. In fact, there has to be a mysterious situation.
Yes.
The detective doesn't know what it's all about.
Yes.
He knows that there's something strange about it, but he doesn't know just what it's all about.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the real mystery is not who killed Sir John in his study, but what the situation really was, what the people were after, what sort of people they were.
Yes, that's exactly what you write about. Of course, you develop your characters very much more than I do. And the thriller element, it seems to me, in your book, is in the people, the character building, and to a considerable extent in the dialogue, which, of course, I think is some of the finest dialogue written in any prose today. And but I think basically we're both of us, to a certain extent, humorists, too. I mean, we're both of us rather like bringing...
That's true.
Which possibly might not come out at first sight, but we like making funny jokes.
Well, a solemn song is really rather a bore.
It is. Mm-hmm. Have you got any particularly favorite thriller writers, Ray? I mean, people who automatically buy more or less blind?
Well, we don't have to buy them. They send them to me free.
They do?
Mm-hmm. The publishers do.
Oh, lucky. I've just bought The Taste of Ashes by Howard Brown.
I guess he's improving quite a lot. Must be.
He read a book called Thin Air before. I don't know if you read that.
No.
Well, it's very good. And then another one called Operator I've just bought. Haven't read yet.
Did you read a book called Knock and Wait a While?
No, I didn't.
An American writer whose name I forget.
No.
It's an intelligence agent story, but I thought it was very real.
I'll write that down. Get hold of it.
His assignment was to prevent a Russian girl from being kidnapped on board a Russian ship and taken back to Russia.
And who was this man, James Anthony Phillips, you were mentioning to me?
James Attlee, A-T-L-E-E.
Attlee Phillips. Well, you said that he was one of the most remarkable mystery writers in America, and I'm ashamed to say
I think he's a damn good writer by any standard.
Yeah. What's he written? This book, Pagoda, you mentioned.
Pagoda, Suitable for Framing, The Deadly Mermaid. And he wrote one called The Shivering Chorus Girls, which I never could get hold of.
Yeah. It's the trouble. I believe there's some very good thrillers, you know, that publishers let get out of print. And vanish off the off the scene. I'm sure in publishers' lists there are a lot of very good thrillers tucked away that have been forgotten and ought to be brought out and brushed out again. There aren't enough good thrillers for me. I mean, I like reading them in aeroplanes and trains. I find they're wonderful kinds of books to pass the time with. Well, anyway, thanks, Fred. It's been nice to see you again.
Well, I love to see you always.
That conversation between Raymond Chandler and Ian Fleming was first broadcast on the third program 30 years ago this month.